Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the growing speculation that Vice President Biden will enter the 2016 Democratic presidential race, which is largely being generated by the media following a column by the New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd, who quoted the late Beau Biden's dying wish that his father run because, quote, the country would be better off with Biden values. Jacob Halbrun, a senior editor at the National Interest and a former senior editor at the New Republic and editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times, joins us to discuss whether Republican Clinton haters and Democratic Clinton haters like Maureen Dowd are concocting this story, or whether the 72-year-old Biden, who would be the oldest candidate to run for the presidency, is actually contemplating challenging Hillary Clinton. Then we'll look into President Obama's announcement today unveiling his clean power plan that he called the biggest, most important step we have ever taken in dealing with climate change. Jody Freeman, the founding director of Harvard Law School's Environmental Law and Policy Program and author of Global Climate Change and U.S. Law, joins us to discuss the first national limits to be imposed on power plants that are responsible for 40% of all U.S. global warming emissions. We'll address the impending blizzard of legal challenges and assess the prospects for a 32% cut by 2030 in carbon emissions from the power sector being implemented under the Clean Air Act. Then finally, we will speak with Duncan Campbell, a veteran British investigative journalist who has been battling his country's draconian secrecy laws for decades. He joins us to discuss changes made since the Snowden revelations and his article at The Intercept, My Life Unmasking British Eavesdroppers. And joining us now is Jacob Halbrun, who is a senior editor at the National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times and a senior editor at the New Republic and a Japan Society Fellow. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jacob Halbrun.
Thanks, Ian.
And what do you make of this story that seems to have been largely prompted by a column from Maureen Dowd in Saturday's New York Times, where she talked about an impassioned request by Beau Biden to his father as Beau Biden was dying. And she quotes Beau Biden here saying, Beau was losing his nouns and the right side of his face was partially paralyzed, she writes. But he had a mission. He tried to make his father's promise to run, arguing that the White House should not revert to the Clintons and that the country would be better off with Biden values. Where do you think that quote came from? I mean, it sounds like something out of a movie.
It is quite melodramatic. I think the whole story is juicy, exciting, and probably not true that Biden is going to run again. He's always aspired to the presidency. But I think for Democrats who have misgivings about Hillary, he is the logical candidate. But the only way that he would capture the nomination is if she suffers a health issue and is unable to continue to run. Otherwise, I think she's pretty much a lock for the nomination.
But even if he, a lot of candidates run probably because they're delusional, which is, I think, the case with almost all of the Republican field running this time. There's no way that the 17 are going to make it. obviously, one person makes it at the end of the day, but most of them aren't even going to make the cut for the debate on Thursday. So is that to say that he wouldn't try to run even if he doesn't have a shot, which is the case with most of the Republicans?
Well, hope springs eternal, but Biden's been through it once before and had to drop out because of the plagiarism of a speech by labor leader Neil Kinnock. And I don't think he has any illusions about the process. And it would split the Democratic Party in half if he were to run. It would set up, in a sense, a succession crisis because both of them have served under President Obama. So I think unless Biden were quite convinced that he could win, he will not run.
But is this being generated by Republican Clinton haters? We know that Maureen Dowd is, I think, presumably a Democrat and certainly a Clinton hater, that she's been pushing this this rumor. But the Republicans, you know, you probably noticed, Jacob Harbron, that Senator Ted Cruz is a huge champion of Senator Bernie Sanders' run on the Democratic side. You know, they just can't do enough to say nice things about Bernie Sanders. So presumably that would apply to Joe Biden. You know, the more the merrier to split the Democratic vote and to split the money in particular.
Yeah, there's no question that if Biden were to run, it would create a war of the roses inside the Democratic Party, because each of them has their own constituency, and then you add into that Hillary Clinton would be the first Democratic female president. Biden represents a more old school approach, but then you layer in all of the reservations that a lot of Democrats have about the Clintons that surfaced when Obama ran originally. So it would be a recipe for a psychic meltdown of the Democratic Party. So sure, the Republicans would love to see Joe Biden runs in the primaries, but I still don't think it's going to happen, barring some complete meltdown of Hillary's campaign before the primaries even begin.
And again, I'm speaking with Jacob Harbron, who's a senior editor at The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for The Los Angeles Times and a senior editor at The New Republic and a Japan Society fellow. Well, the sources for this story are pretty thin, apart from Maureen Dowd, who has this, you know, very melodramatic dying wish of Beau Biden's that she's come up with, and I'm not quite sure how that is sourced, but, you know.
Well, I thought it was extraordinary that the Times would quote their own columnist on a front page story as a source for this story.
Well, there aren't any other sources except ABC News' Cecilia Vega that says one of Biden advisors told her that he was 90% in Biden. And that's about it. I mean, there's not. Biden himself hasn't said a word.
No, and I don't think he will, but he likes to be perceived as a potential candidate for the presidency because it helps maintain his influence in Washington. He's less of a lame duck the longer he's seen as a possible candidate. Now, to Democrats, of course, he looks good as long as he's not actually running. And for the press, which thrives on conflict, it would be a tremendous boon if Biden were to run, because Bernie Sanders will be able to inflict a few jabs against Clinton, but he can't deliver the knockout punch. And what the press would like to see, obviously, is a battle royale for the nomination. It just makes for a better story. You know, the conservatives who always allege media bias tend to forget that the press just wants to see strife and turmoil, because those make for exciting stories.
Well, the press are getting it in spades, aren't they, from the Republicans?
But not on the Democratic side. It looks more like a coronation.
Right, right. Well, that's true. It's a pretty dull comparison to the Republican field.
Well, they've desperately been trying to build up Bernie Sanders as much as possible, and I think that the Clinton camp has also been building up Bernie Sanders, and to make it appear as though he could pose a threat to her, that she's overcoming this force. And so there are a lot of people floating different balloons out there.
Well, but Barney Frank, former congressman, who I think is a pretty sophisticated political insider on Democratic politics in particular, He's gone public saying that he's very concerned about the Bernie Sanders run, that it's going to cut into money that Clinton would otherwise need to run against the Republicans, who we know are going to be incredibly well-funded. If you followed what just happened down here in south of here in Los Angeles, in Dana Point, with the Koch brothers conclave this year, where they put up, I think, pledged $889 million to defeat Hillary and the Democrats. So
you're saying $1 billion can go a long way.
Well, from one source, that's not bad, is it?
It's an astronomical sum of money.
Yeah, right. What I want to say about what Barney Frank was saying is that he was saying that Sanders is eating into Hillary's money that she would otherwise be spending against the Republicans, and two, that the Democratic voters are now being, told, or at least they're assuming that the only reason that she's showing any signs of being a liberal is because Bernie's forced her to be a liberal.
I think that's correct. I think for Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders is a good thing because she needs to have some competition. Martin O'Malley's not going to cut it. He's forcing her to address the concerns of the Democratic base. He's pushing her to the left on economics without her adopting his program wholesale. But absent Bernie Sanders, I think she would walk into the election as someone who had, not undergone any real criticism or attacks, and that she does need to be toughened up for the general election. I mean, against Obama, she really faltered.
Well, I think some people think she's faltering already against Bernie. I mean, for example, Bernie Sanders did this a weekend of house parties, and I think over 100,000 people participated in it. And he's raising a lot of grassroots money and getting more and more donors than I think anybody else in the race, either on the Democratic or the Republican side. And you have to ask yourself, Jacob Heilbrun, why isn't Hillary doing that? He's capturing the grassroots and the Democratic left, and he deserves it. He's earning that. She's not doing it. So what explains that?
Well, I think to some extent, you called Maureen Dowd a Clinton hater, but there is a problem with the Clintons. I mean, they do not really represent the base of the Democratic Party anymore. They essentially consort with financiers on Wall Street and have probably in many ways lost touch with what the values of the Democratic Party are today. And we're not in the 1990s, where the Democratic Party under Clinton moved toward the center right. I mean, he essentially apes much of the Republican Party on police issues, on social issues, and on economics, too. He was fairly conservative, balancing the budget. So I'm not sure that the Clintons, are really in tune with where the Democratic Party is today. But Hillary has to try and reinvent herself now. But Sanders is in closer contact with what the Democratic Party really represents.
Well, of course, to buttress what you just said, Jacob Heilbrun, President Clinton has had to repudiate a lot of his policies of late, like three strikes, filling up the prisons. I don't know whether he's ever really. He has also said that repealing Glass-Steagall was a bad idea, but never in any forceful way that I can recall. But
let's face it, the people around Clinton were people like Larry Summers. Now, it's true that Barack Obama, took on some of those people, but by and large, Obama is to the left of where Clinton was. Now, what people among Democrats worry is that Hillary Clinton would represent a reversion to this older style. And also, don't forget that Hillary Clinton is a hawk on foreign policy. I see very little distinction between her and many of the Republican candidates.
Well, then she's going to have a hard time, isn't she? Why is she so far ahead in the polls? If it is, after all, the Democratic base that elects her in the primaries, and you're making a case that she's not very appealing to the base.
I think she has deficiencies that she's trying to address. The thing is, what her positives obviously are, is that she has a tremendous amount of experience. She has been vilified by the right, and she would be the first woman president, which would be, you know, another historic marker for Democrats. So I'm not saying that Hillary Clinton is unelectable. I suspect that she probably will win the election and become president. But she is not without glaring deficiencies. And let's see if she can address them or not. But the Biden thing is a further indication of just how uncomfortable the Democratic Party is psychologically with Hillary Clinton. And Biden would run to the left of Hillary on economics as well.
Well, given that this is not good news for the Democrats, even if it's not true that Biden is going to run, and it's largely a concoction of either, you know, as I said, Clinton haters on the left and Republican Clinton haters, and it's certainly definitely a concoction so far of the press and words have come out of Beau Biden's dying wish that are pretty hard to pin down. But at some point or other, if this is the case, surely Biden himself has got to step up and basically clear the air and say he's not running.
That's right. But I don't think he would do it if he wasn't going to run. I think he would do it in the fall. Right now, it keeps his name out there. He maintains his visibility. And he makes him a more important person in Washington, D.C. So, and why foreclose your options when you don't know exactly what's going to occur?
So you don't think there's any communication with him or Obama? Or would he be concerned? If the Democrats don't win the presidency, they're not likely to take back the House, and they're not likely to take back the Senate. If America had one-party rule, particularly this particular Republican Party, we'll head towards an oligarchy at warp speed.
Well, I don't think that Obama's going to overtly intervene, but I still think this is just the summer the summer silliness, and I don't put that much stock in the story. So my guess is that Hillary will rumble to the nomination with a few speed bumps represented by Bernie Sanders.
And an imaginary speed bump by Joe Biden.
Yeah, I mean, he will, if he decides not to run, which I assume he has, I'm sure he will enthusiastically endorse her and campaign for her as well.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Jacob Harbron.
Thanks, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jacob Harbron, who is a senior editor at The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for The Los Angeles Times, a senior editor at The New Republic, and a Japan Society fellow. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into President Obama's announcement today of the Clean Power Plan to cut emissions from coal-fired power plants responsible for 40% of all U.S. global warming emissions. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jody Freeman, who is the Archibald Cox Professor at Harvard Law School and the founding director of the Law School's Environmental Law and Policy Program. The co-author with Michael Gerard of Global Climate Change and U.S. Law. She's also served as Counselor for Energy and Climate Change in the Obama White House in 2009 to 2010 and was the architect of the President's historic agreement with the auto industry to double fuel efficiency standards. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jody Freeman.
Thank you.
And I think it's pretty extraordinary, at least to my mind, that there has been no national limits on carbon pollution from power plants in this country, even though they are responsible for about 40% of all carbon emissions in the country.
You're right. It's a big step forward. Part of the problem has been that Congress has not wanted to do anything about this problem. So it took this administration to say, you know what, we're going to use the Clean Air Act and the law on the books, and we're going to set a rule for these carbon emissions from the power sector.
And basically what the president is aiming for here is a reduction of carbon emissions from the power sector by 32% by 2030 compared to 2005 levels. So that's
right.
And in his speech today, he likened his plan to taking 166 million cars off the road in terms of environmental impact. And he also went on to say that this taking the stand against climate change is a moral obligation. So where do you think the public is on this? Are they listening?
I do think the public listening. You know, I think things are shifting. I think we're at a moment of political inflection. And the president has decided that it's the right time to go to the public and say, the science tells us this is a serious problem. We can make a transition to a cleaner energy economy, and we should start now instead of delaying. And I think people are really listening to the message. Part of it is very positive. You know, the president sees this as a transition to new innovation, new jobs, a kind of new clean energy moment in America. And I think that's really the right way to see it. His program that sets these limits on the old, dirtiest coal and gas-fired plants is really going to stimulate new energy, new renewables, wind, solar, and really creative opportunities in the economy. So I think it's a real win-win. It's going to cut pollution, but it's also going to stimulate innovation.
Well, already there seems to be. I mean, first of all, if you look at the other choices in terms of stationary sources for generating electricity, nuclear is dead in the water. There's simply no money from Wall Street for nuclear. There hasn't been a nuclear power plant, I think, for decades.
Actually, what's interesting is there are three new reactors under construction in the southeast, and they're going to move forward, and now there will be a market for their energy. It will be rewarded now. So you may see a shift in nuclear that makes it somewhat more economically available, because the more we put limits on carbon, the more we put a price on carbon, we make these alternatives more favorable. They can compete now. But you're right. It's not as if we've had a ton of nuclear come online since the 1970s.
And the point I wanted to make was that it's largely because of the investors. And in this case, they seem to be investing in gas-fired plants, right, which on average issue about half of the carbon dioxide, a third of the nitrous oxide, and a hundredth of the sulfur dioxide per megawatt hour than coal plants.
It's true. Natural gas is a far cleaner option than coal. And so what this rule is going to do by setting standards is it's going to drive natural gas to be used in place of coal. And you're right, utilities are already shifting to coal, away from coal to gas, because gas is so much cheaper at the moment. There's so much of it. But really, this isn't the solution long term, because natural gas, even if it's cleaner, is actually still a greenhouse gas. It's still putting carbon pollution into the atmosphere and contributing to climate change. So you need a program that's going to stimulate substitutes that are low carbon, like the renewables we talked about, and even nuclear. And that's what the plan's going to do over time.
But already the second source, the new source apart from gas plants, the second largest sources of new capacity has been wind power. So that's already happening.
It is already happening. The problem with it is, as fast as it is coming online, it's still a tiny share of the electricity supply. And so it needs a boost, and it's going to get a boost because there are credits in this federal program the president announced today that incentivizes new renewable energy projects and gives them credits toward compliance if companies will voluntarily build those projects early. So you'll see more wind, more solar come online as a result, and it'll just build on what you said is correct, which is it's already happening.
So in terms of your book, Jody Freeman, Global Climate Change and U.S. Law, that seems to be where it's all heading, right? This is there's going to be a blizzard of lawsuits, and my understanding is that this initiative on the part of the president announced today is going to be challenged at every state.
Yes, and blizzard is exactly the right word. Sometimes I call it a ground war against the climate plan. What we're going to see is a lawsuit launched immediately to challenge the plan in federal court. And what the states and the industry challengers are going to say is that the court should immediately suspend the rule. They should stop it in its tracks while the court hears the challenge. And they want to do that to shut the momentum down. They want to stop the states and the utility industry from actually planning and taking steps toward complying with this new plan. I think that effort is going to fail. I think they won't make out the legal standard they need to show to get the rule suspended. They need to show they will suffer irreparable harm in the 6 months or a year while the court hears the challenge. And they just won't suffer that harm because the plan is so smart. The plan gives lots of time to the utilities and to the states to plan and to transition. And so there's no urgency. They don't need to suspend the rule. But after that, you'll see exactly what you described. You'll see the litigation, the challenges go from the initial federal court, probably all the way to the Supreme Court. That could take a year or two. And you'll see the states filled with challenges to different aspects of the rule. So this is going to play out over a long period of time. Lots of lawyers making a lot of money challenging this rule. But what I like to say is, meanwhile, things are happening on the ground. You'll see change. You're already seeing the power sector start to adapt and invest, and you'll start seeing states starting to plan and move forward. So dynamics on the ground are going to change even while the lawsuits play out.
But will these changes happen because of executive action, or will they happen because of the marketplace?
You know, it's a great question, and I think it's a combination. I think the marketplace is making clean natural gas the preferred option over coal. I think there are lots of drivers in the marketplace, too, for energy innovation. But I think this rule is crucial because what it does is it creates for the first time a federal driver for what's happening in the market and what's happening in some of the states, like California, which are leading the way. We now have a federal plan that says we are going to move this forward with a set of standards that apply to these power plants for the first time. So it will be a combination of market and regulation, and we will make progress to lower carbon energy.
So just to go down the list of the most coal-dependent states, West Virginia, 95% at the top, then Kentucky, Wyoming, Indiana, Missouri, Utah, North Dakota, Nebraska, Ohio, New Mexico. So you can expect all of those states to weigh in.
Yes, they've already signaled the heavy coal states are very likely to join a lawsuit to try to defeat the plan. But it's funny, you know, some of these states are very busy behind the scenes thinking of smart ways to transition out of their dirtier energy, and they're doing it for other reasons. You know, they're doing it because the plants are clunkers anyway. They're doing it, as you said, because there are market forces like cheaper gas around to use. So they're blustery and they're objecting to the plan publicly, but behind the scenes they're actually doing some interesting things.
Well, there's also another interesting graph that estimates 2013 emissions. On one side you've got CO2 emissions in millions of kilotons, and China is the number one. And then you've got per capita tons, and China is under half of the U.S., even though the U.S. is coming in second per capita in terms of pollutions, where we are, I think, the highest in the world. Perhaps Australia is pretty much close to us. And if you go down the list, China is at the top, I guess the worst offender, then the U.S. second, even though we are the worst offenders per capita. And then the EU third, then India fourth. But then there's one that I've never noticed before. The fifth is international travel. Were you aware of that, Jody?
I wasn't. You're teaching me something here. That's great.
Yeah. After that, of course, is Russia, Japan, Germany, and so on down the list. That's pretty shocking, isn't it?
It is pretty shocking. But, you know, what's so interesting about this is we've been the biggest historical emitter of these emissions. So we have a responsibility. We're still a huge consumer of energy in terms of global comparisons. But you're right that China and India, the developing world, of course, has been catching up and, in fact, overtaking us because they're now enjoying the kind of development we already enjoyed, which is fueled by fossil energy. But what's interesting is China's doing amazing things. China's piloting a bunch of cap-and-trade programs and experimenting with various technologies and building a ton of renewable energy. So their objection to us is, look, as you just pointed out, you guys consume a lot more per person. You know, don't put the burden on us exclusively. So what's interesting is the president and President Xi of China, remember, have announced together that they're going to tackle this problem. That was very historic to see the president of China come and stand beside the president of the United States and say, we understand our responsibility and we're going to move forward together internationally. That's the other reason this plan is so important, the plan announced today, because now the President of the United States can go into the international arena and say, look what we're doing, we're serious. We put these efficiency standards in place for cars, and now we're regulating power plants, and now we're doing credible things to contribute to addressing global warming, and now the international community has to combine forces and do the same. That gives the President tremendous credibility when he goes to Paris later this year. And so the plan is going to provide really important momentum to international negotiations.
So how do you think this is going to play out in the election year? We're already in an election year, effectively, but it doesn't start till next year.
It always feels like an election year, doesn't it?
particularly on Thursday night, it will.
Look, this is crucial. You can do all the work you want passing a rule like this, but because it's coming from the executive branch, from the president's Environmental Protection Agency, it has nothing to do with Congress, which means a new president, if they don't like it, can just stop the rule. You know, they can basically rescind it or slow it down. So the message of all this is, if you like this, if you like clean energy innovation and you like this power plan, you have to vote. You have to vote for candidates who take this problem seriously and who want to do something about cleaning up our energy supply.
Well, already Republican presidential candidate Marco Rubio said Obama's plan announced today would be catastrophic. And then former Florida Governor Jeb Bush said the plan was irresponsible and overreaching. In terms of I don't know what where the country is, frankly, in terms, because there's been such a concerted effort to finance and propagate global warming denial. And Unfortunately, to some extent, we have a convention in our press where in the universe of discourse, there are two equal and opposite opinions. So you can equate evolution with creationism and to some extent, the pseudoscience that opposes global warming has been used, you know, by Fox News and others as the other side of the coin. You know, the other opinion, fair and balanced, and all that. So we've definitely not caught up with the rest of the developed world in our awareness. So where do you think we are in terms of whether the electorate will support the deniers as opposed to those that recognize this enormous challenge that the entire planet faces?
You know, I think the electorate's pretty smart, and I think the media is catching on that the overwhelming consensus just can no longer be denied. You're right. There's this sort of, on the one hand, on the other hand, attitude that really is silly. At this point, we know what's happening, and we know that the way to fix it is actually more affordable now than if we wait in the future. And that's why these candidates who are out there saying the plan is disastrous or unworkable, it's just silly stuff. This is a really responsible plan. It's affordable. Power plants can very cheaply reduce their emissions by investing in renewable energies, by investing in energy efficiency. You know, we can do a little bit less to consume energy and save the need to build more power plants. There are a lot of low-cost options. And I think what you're talking about, it's really true that the political conversation has to change for this to really gain more momentum. But I think we're seeing it happen. I think the president's announcement's going to help things move along. I think the public likes clean energy. I think it's something that interests people and they're attracted to it. And once they see that overall their bills are going to go down with cleaner energy, because that's what this plan shows over time, they're going to embrace it.
Well, just in the last minute or so, Jody Freeman, the Germans, of course, have really moved ahead on solar, and they don't have anything like the sun we have here in California, and they also moved ahead on wind, and they have a system of buy-in where people generate their own electricity, and it's deducted from their bills. Mm. Here we have the Department of Water and Power, which is a publicly owned utility in Los Angeles, but they're very bureaucratic and not particularly friendly. So what's going to be done to when people, as their influence, as you said, want to go to solar, but they need to be able to be hooked up to the grid and feed the grid and get a credit for doing so.
Right. You know, utilities like DWP and others, they're going to have to catch up, and they're going to have to get smarter and respond to consumer demand. The problem is, in the past, there was no driver making them do that. And I think this plan is going to help by setting standards that force power plants to reduce their pollution. And so the power plants are going to be looking for solutions. And utilities are going to have to cut through the red tape and figure out ways to change their business model. You know, their business model has always been sell more energy, make more money, more consumption, more profit. And we're now entering a period of time in which they're going to have to learn to make money by helping people save energy and by helping people use cleaner energy. And once you start to see that shift, the business model will drive a regulatory change and we'll see things move much faster.
Well, Jody Freeman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Jody Freeman, who's the Archibald Cox Professor at Harvard Law School and the founding director of the law school's Environmental Law and Policy Program, the co-author with Michael Gerard of Global Climate Change and U.S. Law. She also served as counselor for energy and climate change in the Obama White House from 2009 to 2010 and was the architect of the president's historic agreement with the auto industry to double fuel efficiency standards. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with a veteran British investigative journalist who has been battling his country's draconian secrecy laws for decades.
There's been a crash on the levee and mama, you've been refused. Well, it's king for king and it's queen for queen. It's going to be the meanest flood that anybody's ever seen. Whoa, mama, you gonna miss your best friend now. You're gonna have to find yourself.
But they beg you, wait my name. I got one hell of a job. We're born for the U.S. of A. Got the responsibility of our nation's top security. But every night and day secret agent.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from the UK is Duncan Campbell, an investigative journalist, author, consultant, and television producer specializing in privacy, civil liberties, and surveillance issues. His best-known investigations led to major legal clashes with successive British governments, and his latest article at The Intercept is My Life Unmasking British Eavesdroppers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Duncan Campbell.
Hi, Ian.
And
good to speak to you.
Thank you. And your story starts out in February of 1977 when you get arrested by the special branch, I guess under Section 2 of the Official Secrets Act. You had met with a British Army signals intelligence operator and a fellow journalist, and thus began your odyssey. So had you decided to become an investigative journalist, a whistleblower, or did you just stumble into this?
I'd been putting pieces together about the secret surveillance of communications since I was a schoolboy, really. I did the first ever story to talk about NSA's partner in global electronic surveillance, an organization called GCHQ. I suspect if they hadn't jumped on me so hard, my career could have taken a different path. I might have ended up producing medical electronic equipment or something like that. But once they jumped and said that merely to inquire was to threaten security, which was absurd and overreached, there was no other course open but to take them on in those terms.
Well, of course, the trial against you was pretty farcical, wasn't it? I mean, their entire case collapsed. The culture and cult of secrecy sometimes borders on the absurd.
You're absolutely right to say that the trial became highly farcical, but you've got to remember that every trial has a beginning as well as an end. And when you go into the main criminal court in the UK that's tried the most famous murderers, spies, terrorists and anything, and you are the one sitting there, and for merely doing your job as a journalist, you're facing 30 years imprisonment. It is more than terrifying.
Well, of course, and here in the United States, the American Revolution against the British Crown was largely fought on the basis of freedom of speech. And that's why the First Amendment to the US Constitution is so important in terms of protection. You in the UK and in Australia and other countries don't have that kind of protection. You're still, the government has the right to pre-clear or seize anything from a journalist based upon the Official Secrets Act. That still is the condition that prevails in journalism.
Things have got a great deal better in the United Kingdom.
Right.
But at the time I started as a journalist, in complete distinction to the United States and the First Amendment and the Bill of Rights, it was a criminal offence to obtain, let alone publish, any government information of any kind that was not officially released. So while pretending to be a modern Western democracy, we in fact operated under an implied state control, which was every bit as bad, at least in the words of the law, as in Soviet Russia.
Well, of course, the adjunct to the Official Secrets Act, in a way, are the libel laws that equally protect the establishment.
We are very unfortunate, and the lawyers are very blessed for the way British libel laws work, yes. That is also true. Although I can't fully agree with the way that's normally put. I'm now in the middle of a case that involves British newspapers also being sued in the US courts for libel. It's not quite as protective as sometimes people say.
So the Echelon program, which you and James Bamford have largely uncovered, it seems to be, the way that I interpret what you've written about, is that that's sort of the bedrock of this relationship, the Five Eyes relationship between the Anglo-Saxon countries?
It wouldn't be quite right to say that Echelon is the bedrock, but it certainly was the first big new project that really brought them together as being a sort of disparate set of Cold War radio listening agencies into carrying out mass surveillance directed against the West throughout the world. We all understood that these agencies had an important role to play in covering the communications of hostile or potentially hostile powers. The shock of Echelon was that they planned with equal or possibly even greater priority to spy on the West's communications whilst also attacking those of the Soviet Union. And that plan was Echelon. It was the first automatic system taking communications into huge mainframe computers. Some of the biggest computers of the time, although they would be trivially powerful now. But at the time, they were the big beasts, and they were used to sort through everyone's communications that they could get hold of. Britain was first with America, and then Australia, Canada, and New Zealand joined in with more stations of the same kind.
Well, my understanding is that the sort of methodology was that because of laws of not spying on sovereign citizens, that echelon allowed, for example, the Canadians to spy on the Americans, the Americans to spy on the Canadians, the British to spy on the Australians and whatever. So you would circumvent whatever laws protected your own citizens against surveillance. Was that the rubric under which it was founded?
I would say no, it's not. That's an effect of the way they operated, and that has changed over time. In the years of the Cold War, most of the country's secret agencies just didn't recognize that any laws regulated them. So we had, as was proven in the hearings of the 1970s, the NSA and the FBI spying on Americans, NSA using GCHQ to get information on Americans, on the civil rights movement, if they communicated internationally, feeding it into the system. Similarly, Canada used Britain, and Britain used Canada to spy on their own politicians. But that's not the reason they created the system. It's one of the ways that an international alliance of secret agencies operating out with any democratic controls can behave. They behave like an intelligence multinational. They serve their own ends, unless they're reined in to serve that which are properly required.
And your article at The Intercept, My Life Unmasking British Eavesdroppers, has a sort of bookend. In the beginning, you get arrested in February of 1977 under the Official Secrets Act, and then in May of 2015, you're hosting a seminar with the former head of the British Secret Intelligence Service, along with, I believe,
the head of GCHQ.
Exactly, your nemesis.
Yes, and you're right to put it in those terms. And the question is, the obvious thing is, first of all, both of the parties must have come on a journey to make that possible, because Robert Hannigan's predecessors as director of our agency, GCHQ, very much wanted me to see me in jail for decades. Come 2015, 2 years after Edward Snowden, we're shaking hands and collaborating in setting out opposed but amiable positions on what electronic surveillance should be. Others must judge, but I don't think my journey has been very far, except that to become well-known and, of course, quite a lot older. GCHQ's journey has taken it from being completely secret, operating out with the law, to being acknowledged, to being regulated, to being subject to oversight committees, and in the last couple of years, realizing itself, and this was the message, I think, of the meeting you refer to, that to work in a democratic society, they had to open up like they had never imagined before and subject themselves to scrutiny internally and publicly, and to new limits and proper regulations on what they might do.
Well, I mentioned the U.S. revolution against the British Crown and the fundamental differences in the laws, and of course, between the U.K. and the U.S. And one of the founding fathers, Benjamin Franklin, famously noted that he who would trade liberty for temporary security deserves neither. So we've always had this tension between civil liberties and national security, at least in the post-World War II era. And at this point, what do you think is the accommodation that can be made, given that we've just had cases here in the United States where people that might well have been influenced by the Islamic State or Daesh in the Middle East commit terrorist attacks here in the United States? It's obviously a very low-cost, easy thing for the Islamic State to do, since they do attract young radicals from the diaspora. But apparently the authorities, and this is what the head of the FBI just recently said, that his biggest frustration is that he simply cannot get into the communications that go on, mostly through social media, because of encryption, which is widely available now.
Well, there's a lot of propaganda and stuff and nonsense in those kind of statements. And they're not supported by any of the evidence. The evidence does show that agencies, and this includes the FBI, are short of resources for boots on the ground, the people to do investigations. The best example of that in the United States is the Boston Marathon bombing investigation, which told a story that it wouldn't have been possible, even if the most immense NSA surveillance was in place, to detect what those two were up to. The same story has happened in Sweden, and in France with Charlie Hebdo, and in Britain with the savage murder of a British soldier in the streets of South London. All of the official inquiries into those events, while presented by politicians as though requiring mass surveillance, in fact showed strikingly that while we absolutely need these security services, what they need is not more spying on ordinary communications and ordinary citizens to try and find bad guys, but the resources for larger targeted surveillance on people whose observed conduct wherever have made them legitimate targets from some suspicion. So that's the common story. And the same as the finding of the Presidential Committee on Civil Liberties looking into the notorious so-called Presidential Surveillance Program, or Stellarwind, which was the program of spying on all American communications introduced by former Vice President Cheney about a month after 9/11. This achieved absolutely nothing, according to the commission, despite many statements of the kind you quoted from the FBI director, except to identify a Californian taxi driver who'd sent some money to a terrorist group out east. That, by any standards, does not meet the test of proportionality under the U.S. Constitution or the Convention on Human Rights or any other convention. It's plainly gratuitous and unnecessary. So I feel that the evidence simply exposes the kind of statement that you quoted, and they've been made in Britain, they've been made in France. But when you get down to the deep and dirty business of intelligence, that is not what they mostly need.
Well, of course, James Comey, the current head of the FBI, who recently made those statements about how what keeps him up at night is his inability to intercept communications from the Islamic State in the Middle East to possible recruits here in the U.S. He's the same person who refused to sign off on Stellarwind, that Cheney, I don't know whether you recall the famous bedside...
The dash to the hospital in Washington.
Where Comey and Mueller, the head of the FBI, and Comey was acting attorney general, and they refused to sign off. We don't even know what Stellarwind was up to at that point, but it was clearly egregious enough for these people not to want to...
Well, that's not true. Early on, Edward Snowden provided about 120-page adjutant general's Inspector General's report, I correct myself, from NSA on the Stellarwind project. And it did reveal an astonishing degree of operating completely outside the law. The Comey FBI incident, I've seen different accounts of. I've seen people call Mr. Comey a great guy because of that, and others say that story is a bit distorted. I'm not read in enough to kind of judge absolutely what the result should be, in my opinion.
Well, but we don't know, for example, whether Dick Cheney and his lieutenant, Scooter Libby, and David Addington and company, who were running an alternative National Security Council, and essentially he was the shadow president. He sort of stole the presidency out from under George W. Bush, who, through the Comey incident, by the way, was the first time that Bush recognized how much Cheney had been basically running his own presidency right out from under him. So we don't know whether what they were doing with that information, whether they were targeting, for example, you know, Senator Teddy Kennedy or whoever, whatever their perceived enemies were. They had that flexibility. That's the big black hole in the record.
Well, I certainly recognize and sympathize with some of that hypothesis. Cheney was the child of the Nixon administration and its exposed and discredited attempts to get at enemies. And I know, including from whistleblowers on and off the record, the enthusiasm with which he guided Bush into the turning NSA inwards on the American people, the exact nightmare that Senator Frank Church had foreseen 25 years earlier. He carried it through. So I agree with that part of what you're saying.
So in terms of where you stand now, looking back at your career exposing British secrets and they've been fairly ubiquitous, and we know that Britain is a more wired country in terms of CCTV, I think, than anywhere else on the earth. How would you make the comparison between, you know, we've had all of the Snowden revelations. At the end of the day, I'm not sure whether civil liberties won or national security won or whether it was a draw. How would you say things are in the UK?
I'd never portray important matters of public policy like a football, sorry. The story of unseating secret surveillance in the Western democracy belongs, the starting chapter belongs in America. I didn't always see this, but I think looking back through a long lens, it was concern about abuses of Vietnam that got everyone going, and ultimately including me. And these layers of secrecy have been pulled back. Freedom of Information Acts, oversight panels, commissions and committees that Congress set up, the same has happened belatedly in Britain. They are getting, in Britain at least, better at it. I think in America the same cannot necessarily be said. At the same time, particularly since the attacks in New York and Washington, the extent to which these have been leveraged to allow unprecedented surveillance into unprecedented levels of accessible personal communications is almost indescribable. And 2 years into studying the material provided by Edward Snowden, I think that legislations people and even commentators such as myself are still coming to terms with understanding and explaining some of it. I think that events have shown that whenever the rabid calls of some politicians, that the message of needing to limit these activities and for them to be better understood and managed has been heard. The background to this, of course, is the appalling state of the Middle East and what it means for other countries, for which Western intelligence bears an immense responsibility. But that doesn't mean that they're not going to try and exploit it when blood is actually found and spilled on any of our streets, whichever side of the Atlantic it is. The core values that the American founding fathers fought for seem just as relevant as ever. Making governments accountable, creating countervailing centers of powers, checks and balances. These lessons have been best learned historically in the heat of revolutions, as in America, but also in the heat of and then the cold light of day of sorting out Europe after the ravages of the Second World War. The challenge to both our societies, all our societies, is to try and reconstruct essential human rights without having to go revolution or war first.
Well, Duncan Campbell, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Duncan Campbell, who is an investigative journalist, author, consultant, and television producer specializing in privacy, civil liberties, and surveillance issues. His best-known investigations led to major legal clashes with successive British governments, and his latest article at The Intercept is My Life Unmasking British Eavesdroppers. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was